brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Inyart, America's most popular self-proclaimed right-wing religious fanatic, homophobic, anti-choice talk show host. Our phone number, 1-800-8-INYART, 1-800-836-9278. The Palestinians with their attacks over the last couple days have provoked Israel to yet another response and a policy change wherein Israel is saying that now it will occupy, it will go back into the West Bank and perhaps Gaza. Gaza seems to be even more of a hotbed of terror and lawlessness than is the West Bank, and that's saying something, that Israel will go back in and take land and hold it, occupy it indefinitely until the entire terrorist problem is resolved. And that is, of course, a good idea. George W. Bush was about to release his own policy clarification on the Middle East and what he thinks should happen vis-a-vis a Palestinian state. And so with the Palestinians just upping the ante and killing as many innocent people as they can, the bus that was blown up a couple days ago had quite a few students on it. I don't know if the 19 who were killed and the 50 injured, I don't know how many were students. But, you know, young kids going to school. But the targets, the Palestinian people have become shameless. The Palestinian people, as a group, have become evil. Evil in that they have built themselves a culture of terror. It's not just a terrorist organization. It's not just one terrorist. It's not just a government that is harboring and promoting terrorism, as is Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority. It is a culture of terror where the government, the education system, the religious leaders, the media have all worked together to get a majority of the Palestinians to support targeting innocent people via suicide bombers, women and children even. I mean, Islam has apparently not served its adherents well, because throughout the Arab part of the world, there is a softness toward terrorism, a softness toward it. Nothing remotely approaching a zero tolerance for terrorism. And in the West Bank and Gaza, within Israel's borders, you've got a majority who respond to Arab polls by Arab news organizations saying that they support suicide bombers, whom they call martyrs, who are actually murderers. Now, I'd like to read to you some quotes, and we'll talk about this, from an article in the Washington Post this week from Charles Krauthammer. Our phone number here, 1-800-8-INYART, 1-800-836-9278. I was talking about this column with a friend, and he had been paying attention to the news, what's going on in Israel. And when I talked to him about the stabbings, not only the suicide bombings, but the shootings and then the stabbings that are becoming so commonplace, Palestinians stabbing Jews, he was surprised. He hadn't heard that. So I think it's worthwhile to go through this. So a few excerpts from Charles Krauthammer's column this week in the Washington Post. He writes that the threat is not just suicide bombings. Random stabbings are frequent, and a stabbing betrays a deep malice. He says that it's a barbarism in cold blood because the terrorist sees his victim, could look right into his victim's eyes as he stabs him or attempts to slit his throat. So Charles Krauthammer says, it is barbarism in the coldest blood, a near daily Daniel Pearl, a knife to the throat of the Jew. And that's a good way to put it, a near daily Daniel Pearl. Because, of course, liberals in this country were horrified when Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl was slaughtered by terrorists who were supportive of Al-Qaeda. And so the Palestinians, whom a lot of liberals in this country try still somehow to be apologetic for, to defend, that's just part of their repertoire, slitting the throat of Jewish civilians. That's just something else to get cheers from the crowds of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. You know, something that upset me after September 11th that George W. Bush did was that after decades of American administrations refusing to agree that Palestinians should have a state in Israel, American policy for decades, we never supported a Palestinian state. Now, Al-Qaeda in the Arab world, those who support terrorism, that's one of their top agenda items, get a Palestinian state. And so shortly after September 11th, George W. Bush changes decades of American policy and comes out in favor of a Palestinian state. And that is certainly one of the demands that Osama bin Laden would have made if he were inclined to make demands before September 11th. He would have said, we want you to do X, Y, and Z, and X is support a Palestinian state in Israel. And so it seemed a bit bizarre to take that time to change our policy and support and take that move, because it's like giving in to the terrorist demands, even their unspoken demands. And so now George W. Bush was, again, he was just on the verge of laying out his plan for how we could begin to recognize a Palestinian state. And with all the terrorist acts that the Palestinian government, the Palestinian Authority, Arafat, Hamas, that they've been guilty of lately, it would be like rewarding them. All right, live commercial break here. We only have 2 minutes. Yesterday I told a story about when I took a Bible as literature class in high school, and my 2 minutes were up and I didn't even sell anything. So today I got to get right to business here. The point of that story was, from back in 1970s, I was going to public high school in New Jersey, and the Bible as literature class, the teacher, was against the Bible. He started out, his very first comment was to make fun of the Bible. And, you know, we didn't want to take that laying down. So we rebutted him successfully. And ever since then, it's been my desire to get to know the truth about the Bible, its message. What is the Bible saying? And why is it the number one best-selling book of all time? And why is it that so many people have tried to destroy the Bible? You might as well put your shoulder to the sun and try to stop it from rising in the morning as try to abolish the Bible from human history. You can't do it. If every Bible in the world was destroyed, we could recreate it 1,000 times over from quotes in millions of other documents. millions of other titles, pamphlets and commentaries and works classics. So we have a passion to study the Bible, and if you'd like to do that with us, call us. You can join us with our audio tapes, 1-888-8-NYART. All right. Also, we have videotapes. Now, that phone number, 1-888-836-9278. The videotapes we have, of course, most of them deal with issues regarding the Bible or the Bible's teachings, like Amy's call. That's a Bob and Yart Live program from television where a woman called in and thought she was good enough to get to heaven. And so we had to take the gloves off and find out, really get a little rough and find out how good was she really. And it turned out she wasn't very good, not even in man's eyes. And she took great offense, of course, at what she was told. And Christians were all upset with the show. But then Amy called in a year later, and she had become a Christian. So Amy's call, call us, get some of these videos. All right, we're back. Bob and Yart Live, 1-800-8-NYART, 1-800-836-9278. Dennis Prager, that's right. My producer just reminded me about Dennis Prager, a supposedly conservative radio talk show host. He airs in Denver on KNUS Radio, a Salem radio station. And I called into his show today. So I'll get back to this Washington Post article about Israel. But let me tell you about Dennis Prager. Salem Radio, sort of like what we see going on in other examples of Christian media, where Christian record labels have been bought up, for the most part, the big ones, by secular music labels like RCA and others. And they do the most filthy rap, and then they do worship to Jesus Christ. Two different, in fact, you could buy both CDs from the same ad in the same newspaper. Filthy, sexually immoral, murder, drugs, incest on one, and worshiping Jesus from the other CD. So something seems not quite right, if you know what I mean. And so we notice in Christian music over the last really 5 years or so, this trend has been going on for a while, maybe five or more years, a trend in Christian music where there's, in secular music, there's a tone that the singers will use, a seductive tone, that they sing almost as though they were having sex while they're singing the song, a seductive tone of voice quality. And it's common in radio, well, in different kinds of modern music. And the Christian artists, mostly the women, have taken to using that kind of tone. So if you took a 10-second clip from a Christian song and just mixed it in to a secular song on an FM long-haired, maggot-infested radio station, they wouldn't notice anything changed. Just sounds the same. Only the Christian group, it's supposed to be worship to God, I guess, with sensual overtones. I guess that's what's going on there with the Christian music labels. And the Christian publishers, the major Christian publishers, have been purchased by the secular publishers. Not all, but a number of them. And the largest Christian distributor has been purchased by secular distributor. And so what we see happening is, for example, if a Christian leader has a book that condemns homosexuality for being perverse and lays out a strategy for how to combat that one problem of the many we have in our country, Do you think the chances are just as good as they were 10 years ago that he could get that book published? Now that maybe Simon & Schuster is the parent company? Yeah, it's getting pretty difficult. And so Salem Radio, that's a radio station, a huge Christian radio network. Well, can we say Christian still? Salem has gone public, and so they're publicly owned and traded. And I didn't even realize that. I don't stay up on all these matters. I get informed like you might, seeing an occasional comment in a newspaper article somewhere. But it's interesting that they've got Dennis Prager on here in Denver, who Dennis Prager is, he's supposed to be a conservative Jew, but I have a hard time finding the conservatism in his comments. And Michael Medved, who's also supposed to be a conservative Jew. And today I got to talk to Dennis Prager for just a few minutes. And you know the Nickelodeon homosexual newscast last night where they were promoting to kids that being a homosexual family is a good thing. And so Dennis Prager on Salem Radio's KNUS, and I don't know what other markets he airs in, but he, here in Denver, he's on KNUS. We're on KLTT, more powerful station than KNUS. KNUS is 710 AM. I don't know how many watts they have. They used to have 5,000. KLTT, the station we're on for 6 months during the summer, we air with 50,000 watts at a lower dial position, 670 AM. So we're excited about that. The lower the dial position on AM, the further you can get with your signal with the same amount of power. So anyway, Dennis Prager was basically, instead of utterly condemning Nickelodeon for airing this program last night with Linda Ellerbe and Rosie O'Donnell and three kids from homosexual families defending the homosexual family, instead of focusing his comments on attacking Nickelodeon for doing that, he was criticizing conservatives for their overreaction against it. And he singled out one conservative news website, and he gave an account of how that they simply lied about the program in order to make it sound sensational. And the lie that he described, which I don't think was a lie. Here's what he said was a lie, that Nickelodeon presented those who oppose homosexuality as hate mongers. That's what the conservative website, how they sized up last night's show. And Dennis Prager said, that's an outright lie. They didn't do that. They were very respectful to both sides. Oh, great. So I got to be the first caller going up to his first break, and we talked for maybe 3 minutes and went to the break, and that was it. And I said, Dennis, do you remember the opening comment by Linda Ellerbe? You said the conservatives are lying when we're saying they're describing us as hate mongers if we're opposed to homosexuality. Her opening statement, the opening words on Nickelodeon last night was this. Sometimes people hate other people because they don't know them. Sometimes people hate others out of ignorance. I said, Dennis, she set the tone for the whole event, laying out the ground rules that if you're against homosexuality, you're a hate monger because you're a fool, you're ignorant, you're a moron. That was the message. And I think that took him off guard. He had said he listened to the program very carefully, and he had recorded it. And he emphasized, I listened to the program very carefully, and it was fair and balanced. Now, he says homosexuality is wrong, but they really did a very good job of presenting both sides, and they did it in a fair and balanced way. And so he says that they didn't present the opponents of homosexuality as hate mongers, but I pointed out Linda Ellerbe's opening salvo. And his response was, well, you're not really giving me any specifics. And I thought, so that gave me the opportunity to repeat the evidence that he had been easily manipulated by that program. And I put it that way. I said, Dennis, you were easily manipulated. And he, being Jewish, is especially interested in what's going on in Israel right now, and rightly so. And he's especially sensitive to those who hate Jews, rightly so. And so I said, so he's presenting it as though it were a reasonably balanced program. So I said, Dennis Prager, this talk show host on Salem Radio, I said, Dennis, what if the show was about skinheads, neo-Nazis, anti-Semites, and they had kids there from families that hated the Jews, and they said, we value all opinions here. And they presented all sides equally and non-judgmentally. Do you think that'd be acceptable? Wouldn't that be despicable, Dennis? Of course it would be despicable. And of course he had to agree with that. And of course he was manipulated because he doesn't have the foundation. It's just like Michael Medved. Some time ago I called into Michael Medved's show just to make the point so the audience would get it, that Michael Medved believes that homosexuality, that people have a right to commit homosexual acts. Michael Medved believes that. Many, many supposed conservatives believe that. Now, homosexuality has been against the law for 3,500 years. When this country was founded, America's founding fathers, when we were the 13 colonies, we had homosexuality as a crime, as it had been for centuries, for millennia. And it was a crime in this country up until, what, the 50s, the 60s? Some states even still have it as a crime, but it's no longer enforced. And so conservatives throughout this country, even Christian conservatives, have joined the dark side, and they say that people have a right to be homosexual. Now, once a society takes that step, it's pretty much over. You see, Christianity and homosexuality are mutually exclusive in public. They cannot both be tolerated. They cannot. So those who shout tolerance have become the most intolerant of Christians. That's what we're putting up with. They've become the most intolerant, and we Christians are running and hiding, and we're going underground. I don't mean us here at Bob and Yurt Live. I don't mean Denver Bible Church, but I mean Christians in general. They're afraid to say that homosexuality is a perversion, that it's sick, that it's wrong. So we've got a mess here, huh? In our country, Israel's got a mess. At least their enemy is foreign. Ours is domestic. All right, Bob and Yurt Live here, and I'd like to tell you about our Nicer Than God album. Nicer Than God. What a phrase. How nice is too nice? Is it possible to be too nice? Among Christians today, one of the most important issues is being nice. That's pretty much, it's up there, I'd say, above the Ten Commandments, being nice. And when you look in the Bible and you do a search for nice, I could do that right here, can't I? Yeah, I've got Al the fourth is my co-host computer. And Al's here, and we could do a search on nice. And Al, tell me, how many times does the word nice appear in the Bible? All right, he wants me to hit enter. I'll hit enter. Look at that. Nice is not in the Bible. That's what Al says. He says it right there. Nice is not in the Bible. Isn't that something? Now, being nice is okay if it hasn't become the priority above godliness, righteousness, above loving your neighbor. You know, being nice to people who are destroying themselves and others is very possibly the worst thing you can do in a particular circumstance. Jesus was not always nice. Sometimes he was rather harsh. Sometimes. The Apostle Paul was not always nice. Sometimes he was rather harsh. Like, remember when he called Peter a hypocrite to his face? Remember that? The Apostle Paul calling the Apostle Peter a hypocrite? Why is it that whenever Paul and Peter got together, there was some kind of tension that needed to be resolved? Why is that? Isn't that interesting? You'd think that, you know, can't we just all get along? Hey, you'd think there are two apostles serving the same Lord. You'd think that everything would be copacetic. But there were problems that had to be resolved. Peter and Paul had problems. And it's interesting that the resolution always went in Paul's favor. Always went in Paul's favor. And Peter was in agreement when he was a hypocrite. When Paul accused him of lying about the gospel, well, he was then later repentant, you can tell. And he pretty much went along with Paul. But why is all that stuff there? Call us. Get our take. one 800 8 NYARDS, 1-800-836-9278. All right. Now, so that was Dennis Prager and Michael Medved. So Salem Radio, you know, in some ways is going the way of Christian music labels, Christian publishers, and Christian distributors. And the distributors, of course, are extremely important, because that's how the bookstores get the material to stock on their shelves. My friend and I, a few years back, we were talking about spanking and how that is the only... That's in the Bible. God, in a number of verses, explains how to discipline a child to parents, and that's pretty much the only form of discipline that God talks about and authorizes. Now, you could maybe be creative and do something else, but that's the one that God gives his stamp of approval on. So we thought this question, we thought, well, what if we go in a Christian bookstore, let's go in a big one, and see if they have any books on raising kids, and then go through the index, the table of contents, and see if any of it has to do with spanking. You know, that kind of discipline, flogging. And we found out that the books that we could not find one book that even mentioned spanking. The couple bookstores we went into. And we went to ask the clerk, the salesperson, for help. We said, do you guys ever have books on spanking? I don't think so. No, come to think of it, no, we've never had anything like that. That's one of the reasons we now sell To Train Up a Child by Michael and Debbie Pearl. Great little book. We sell it in our Train Up a Child kit with a couple sermons I've given on raising kids. We sell the little book and the sermon To Train Up a Child. You could call us 1-888-836-9278. Get that. And that little kit, oh boy, could that kit save a family a lot of grief. Maybe eternal grief. But why is it that Christian bookstores don't stock books about spanking? Well, spanking is politically incorrect. And the Christian media is strongly going in the direction of political correctness. So you're going to have a hard time finding anything supportive of spanking in your local Christian bookstore. Now, I haven't read James Dobson's new book, Dare to Discipline, the new edition, the new Dare to Discipline. But I read the old one back in the 70s before I had kids, so I'd be prepared. And that was rather supportive of spanking. But I've been told by others, and I haven't confirmed this. I don't have time to read the book again. But I've been told by others that the new edition is really softened up on the spanking. And that seems sad if that's true. Maybe somebody out there could confirm that. We don't want to spread rumors here. But it just has the ring of, oh, so much, just the flavor of realism with that comment. It just sounds right. All right, back to the Washington Post and this column by Charles Krauthammer about what's going on in Israel. And in Israel, they have a Daniel Pearl almost every day, a knife to the throat of the Jew, he writes. And he continues that Palestinian terrorism has been counterproductive. Not everyone, he writes, likes Ariel Sharon, but almost everyone in Israel agrees with the tough military measures that he takes against the Palestinians. Those who do differ with Sharon complain that he has been too soft. And how true that is. You know, the American media, they, so many times, CNN and others, I've seen them imply that in Israel there was a lot of dissent against Sharon's military response to the terrorist. And that was rather deceptive because, in truth, the loudest, the biggest part of the dissent was that Sharon should be doing a lot more than he was doing, a lot tougher, use a lot more force, kill a lot more terrorists and the terrorist infrastructure, kill the government officials who support terrorism. That's the biggest voice in the dissent. But our media, just like, you know, Ted Turner, CNN, AOL, Time Warner, that Ted Turner saying that the Jews are guilty, like the Palestinians are, of terror and making them morally equal. Now, how despicable is that? And, yeah, how despicable is that? All right, let's go to the phones in Colorado Springs. Doug, speak your mind. Hello, Doug. Hey, Doug, welcome to Bob and Yurt Live. No, I can't hear Doug. All right, Doug, I'm going to put you back on hold, and we'll see if we can't get you up here. But doesn't seem like it, huh? All right, I'm putting you on hold, and we'll see if we can get to you. All right, now, so this Washington Post article column from this week points out that, hey, those in Israel who disagree with Sharon, for the most part, they're all saying that he's too soft. And Krauthammer writes, the psychological effect of Operation Defensive Shield, and that's the name of their, when the Jews went in to the West Bank in March and they stayed there till May, they called that Operation Defensive Shield when they had Arafat pinned down. And he said the psychological effect of that operation has been remarkable. No one imagined that it would end the terror. Of course not. But Israel's April offensive and subsequent raids to pick up suspects and intelligence have reduced the terror attacks significantly. It also has combated the psychology of helplessness, which is the chief objective of all terrorism. And that's right. You know, the terrorists want you to feel helpless so you'll cave in to their political demands. But when Israel takes strong steps against the terrorism, then their populace, they don't feel helpless. And that in and of itself is a great defense against the greatest dread, which is giving in to terrorist demands. Because then you codify and you make terrorism a permanent part of the political landscape when you give in to it. And that's what gets me so sick about the current administration urging that Israel negotiate with terrorists. And not only that, our own government negotiating with terrorists. Man, the Secretary of State, has he ever met a Palestinian terrorist that he didn't honor? Colin Polop. Has he ever met a Palestinian terrorist that he did not honor, shake his hand, that he was not gracious toward? You don't honor terrorists. It makes me sick. It really does. Because it guts our own moral defense of our own war against terrorism when we tell Israel that they should negotiate with their terrorists. Where's that coming from? That's coming from a complete lack of understanding about moral principles. All right, we're going to go back here to Colorado Springs. Doug, speak your mind.
Hello, Bob.
Howdy, Doug.
How you doing, sir?
Doing well.
Good. The reason I'm calling, Bob, is about this fire we have here in Colorado right now.
Yes.
The Hainan fire.
Yeah.
As I look out to the west of near Pikes Peak, the whole sky is just cloudy with smoke.
So you're in Colorado Springs.
Yes.
Hey, Denver. Now, we're, what, an hour and a half north of you guys?
Hour and 15 minutes, maybe?
Yeah. Southern Denver, it was really pretty cloudy today from the fire. And so Colorado Springs, you guys must have got hit.
Yeah, I can't breathe in the morning. It's choking. My voice is bad.
Oh, that's terrible.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, the reason I was calling, Bob, is about this fire. It never had to happen in the first place. It never had to happen. And I have an authority on the line with me right now who has for almost 10 years been trying to get the government and trying to get firefighters and different entities such as our congressmen interested in and being able to fight these fires much more effectively than what they can do right now. Did you see that plane crash in California?
California, the slurry craft.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have Ed Herlick on the line. I'm on my cell phone. I've three-wayed you in.
Oh, you
on
do.
A three-way conference call. Ed is on the line right now.
Okay.
And Ed is the authority, and when it comes to fighting forest fires.
Okay. So Ed, welcome to Bob and Yurt Live.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
So this fire, of course, we now know it was started by a forestry worker, a federal government employee, but obviously you have information regarding fighting a forest fire. So if you can hold, we're right up to a break, but we'll come right back to you. All right, Bob Enyard here, live commercial break. Hey, so Nicer Than God, that album that we have, it's a 6-take audio album, and it deals with questions about judging. Christians have been seduced into thinking that they're not supposed to judge. How is that? We're not supposed to judge? Well, then how do we know that unbelievers, unrepentant unbelievers will go to hell? How do we know that adulterers are wrong? Or that child molesters, murderers, abortion. If you can't judge, you've been taken out of the battle. And that's what's happened to so many Christians. Even on that Nickelodeon show last night, the kid who's a Christian, he's finally going to say, he's going to say something good, that children need a mom and a dad. But he has to counter his own statement with, well, we're not supposed to judge. What in the world are you talking about, kid? But he's only a kid. It's not his fault. It's the adults. It's the Christian teachers. It's the pastors of the mega churches. The Christian TV evangelists who've repeated the mindless Hillary quote, judge not. That's the Hillary quote. If you're going to quote Hillary, then quote, judge not lest ye be judged, because that's her verse. Jesus Hillary stops right there. So you're mimicking Hillary when you quote that. Jesus went on to say, judge not, you hypocrite. If you're committing the same sin, then repent, and then you can judge your brother. That's what Jesus said. That's what Jesus said. Hillary didn't say that other stuff. So we have this album, Nicer Than God, where we talk about judging and forgiving. Are we supposed to forgive everyone at all times, under all circumstances? If you don't forgive, God won't forgive you. That's what Christians are taught. Oh, really? I thought we were saved by grace. I didn't know it was works. Yet Jesus said, if you don't forgive, God won't forgive you. Why did he say that? What does that mean? How does that fit in with being saved by grace and not by works? Why did Jesus himself say, if someone sins against you, forgive him? No, he didn't say that. He said, if someone sins against you, rebuke him. And if he repents, forgive him. How do you understand all this? Call us. Try the tapes. We're back. Bob and Yart Live, 1-800-8-N-YART. And we're on with Doug and Ed. Ed, you're involved in, you're like a firefighting activist?
Well, Bob, actually what I am is a jet pilot and an inventor.
You're a jet pilot and what?
And an inventor.
Okay.
I do intellectual property, patents, that kind of stuff.
All right.
And, in fact, Doug tells me that we're about to lose his cell phone battery.
Yeah, we could lose it.
Yeah, the details are on firehogs.com in case we lose you.
All right, firehogs.com.
Right. You know, the firefighters will tell you that this fire that we're having right now is really does boil down to common sense. It doesn't matter how it started, who lit it, if it was a cigarette or even a 90-year-old coal seam. It doesn't matter. Fires are going to happen.
Right.
The huge difference is what we do about it in about the first 20 minutes. We right now, and that air tanker that crashed,
yep.
The only system that could possibly get to a fire in time, especially in Colorado's terrain, is by air. Nothing else is going to be fast enough.
Right.
But our firefighters, the aerial firefighters, are kept on such a shoestring that they use only airplanes that no one else will fly, like that C-130 that crashed. It was retired by the military 25 years ago because the design was unsafe.
Mm.
Just that one particular model of C-130 was unsafe because the wings can fall off.
I am on national radio.
If they continue to fly airplanes like that,
the KLTT in Denver is one of the stations carrying it.
Yes, Ed.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
So the proposal, for example, we've made is to take relatively modern 1980s military technology that's been retired. It was retired after Desert Storm. There's hundreds of airplanes in the desert out in Tucson in storage.
Right.
Add some modern systems to them so that they can patrol and find these fires and put them out before they become the evening news.
So you're saying that there should be planes on patrol during high alert seasons?
They're called red flag days. It's like yesterday when the conditions are so explosive that any ignition will get out of control in minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously you'd have the airplanes around to be on call during the fire season, just like tankers are these days.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the part of government that runs this is about the most stuck-in-the-mud status quo organization you've ever wanted to meet, to the point where the most modern plane they fly is that 130 that broke up in flight.
Hmm.
That's about the best they have.
Well, you have a good opportunity now to make your case, Ed.
Well, yeah, but, you know, the planes have crashed before, and Malibu's burned a couple of times, and firefighters have died by the dozen, and it hasn't helped.
Do you, there's... So much about what our government does doesn't seem right. I remember the firefighters who died with a blaze that was almost out in the Northwest, and they had called for water to be dropped.
Right.
And the helicopter would have to scoop the water up out of an endangered species lake. And there was a delay for a couple hours in getting permission to scoop water out of that lake, because it had a fish that was endangered.
Well, and that actually brings up a problem in that in the military, for example, if the order is going to hurt someone and it's obvious the leadership doesn't have all the information, it's very likely someone will take initiative and just do it. The system that fights fire is so vertically structured, it's pretty much like the post office, where you will lose your job regardless of how well you did.
Right.
So that's why that hesitation was so strong and ingrained.
Yeah, and to save a fit, and we actually lost some firefighters that day who, and according to the news accounts I read, it was a completely unnecessary loss because that fire was almost controlled. In fact, the crack teams we have handed it over to the second string because it was pretty much wrapped up.
Well, sure, and fires are very unpredictable that way, which, again, goes back to my original point that if you don't stop them in about the first 20 minutes, it's actually a size between 5 and 10 acres.
So you
simply never will.
So you're saying these military planes that were decommissioned in the 1980s, you're an inventor and you've added some what to them?
Well, the basic airplane is the A-10.
Right.
You know what that is. It's a big, ugly thing that kills tanks.
Right.
The point is that of all of the airplanes we have fighting fire, only the little crop dusters were designed for this job. They're the only ones that were designed to fly low and slow and drop anything. The rest of them are converted airliners, for example, a DC-7. There's a Lockheed Electra's out there flying around. There is an airplane I saw flying here in southern Colorado last week. It's a PB-4Y, which is a B-24, a World War II B-24 out here fighting fire. None of them were designed to do this kind of stuff. Well, the A-10 was designed for close air support. It was designed for exactly this environment of flying any place it needs to go and dropping things very, very close to the good guys. So you start with an airframe that was designed to be there in the first place.
Right, right.
And then you don't have so many of the just simple aviation accidents that we've had so far. California, for example, has a fleet of 14 little airplanes of their own.
Right.
They've crashed 17 of them. Now think about that.
Yeah, that's a tragedy.
And it's because the planes fly outside their design envelope and they crash. They've crashed some of them twice before they finally killed the pilot.
Hey, Ed, while you're talking, we're hearing instant messages from, I think, retired military.
Oh, yeah?
And somebody's saying the A-10, that's his favorite, and they fired uranium-depleted 30-millimeter shells.
Well, they do, but the gun would come out to fight fire.
Okay.
The point is, you start with an airplane that can do that, and it comes with a bombing system that's the most accurate thing the firefighters have ever seen. It's none of this Kentucky windage stuff. The computer calculates where you need to go to put the retardant in exactly the same place.
Well, when we decommissioned these planes, what did we do with them? Did we disassemble
them?
Well,
again, if the folks, if your audience goes to firehogs.com, they'll see photos of these things lined up out in the Arizona desert wrapped in plastic. So there's roughly 180 of them stored in Arizona, roughly another 60 of them just pushed off on the side in various Air Force bases, maybe on display, maybe being used to, they punch holes in them and then repair them for practice, for example.
Right.
What about the cost? Talk about the cost, Ed, when you get a chance.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And so to that, we would add specialized systems for firefighting, like an ultraviolet fire detection system that can actually be tuned to the frequency of the fires so that you only see the kind of fire you want, like burning wood, for example. If you had a red flag day and flew them actually on patrol, it's very likely that the pilots would end up being the ones to report the fire they just dumped a bunch of retardant on so that the ground firefighters can then go mop up. Don't make any mistake. These things will never, ever replace the guys and gals on the ground.
Right. No, of course not. And when a fire gets out of hand, like we have in Hayman, with how many acres are we up to?
Last I heard was 120,000.
120,000 acres, more probably 16 square miles or so.
It's a lot.
a tragedy. We at that point, it seems like fighting it from the air, it's got to be part of the strategy, but it almost seems like you just get a defeatist attitude looking at the scope of the fire.
Well, it does, actually. And right now, the best thing the air tankers are doing is saving individual spots, like a home or trapped firefighters. They cannot affect the fire in general.
Right.
But what they can do is take a last stand to protect something we really, really care about. That would be the other thing the A-10s would do, because no one's going to stop every fire, no matter how good you are.
Right.
At some point, fires will escape, and then you really care about the spots, the individual spots that you really have to save, like someone's life or someone's home. In that case, you you need planes that can fly at night. The A-10 is the only one that could do that. You need planes that can see inside smoke. You notice planes are routinely grounded for smoke.
Hmm.
Given the stereo infrared vision system that would be designed into this airplane, they are the only ones that could fly either at night or in the smoke cloud. And you need them to be extremely accurate because you're talking about dropping basically right behind guys who are running for their lives.
Now, infrared, for a time back in the 80s, I worked for McDonnell Douglas Helicopter Company on the simulators for the Apache helicopter.
Yeah.
And we used to get to sit in a hangar in Culver City, California, and put on the night vision system.
Now that's different.
And look out. Right. And a fire would sort of wipe that system out. It'd be too hot.
That's because night vision amplifies light.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the light from the fire, it amplifies it and beams it into your eyes. Infrared is simply a different frequency of light. They're totally different things.
And so although I guess what your system would be doing is searching out that heat and looking for a fire that you might not spot otherwise.
Well, actually, the problem with the smoke is not so much how it affects the airplane, it's that you cannot see through it. And it, given frequencies and wavelengths and all that nonsense, infrared actually cannot see smoke that is cold.
Hmm.
So the smoke that's hot would show up, and the guys can tell where the hot spots are from that.
Right.
But just the smoke that's obscuring the sky would be invisible to an infrared system.
Mm-hmm.
And there's videos that show all that stuff.
So, Ed, you must have tried to get these arguments through to various people in government, the Forestry Service?
Well, the folks in Colorado are pretty well informed. I mean, the bottom line is to build the first set of them right here in Colorado Springs, where they'd be pretty darn useful right now.
Yeah.
It has a lot to do with the fact that the Forest Service and the other federal agencies around it dominate this environment.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really pin the feds down, they will point to the 1897 law that created the Forest Service and say there's nothing in that law that allows them to fight fires in off of federal land, which by definition means in the suburbs.
Hmm.
So when you ask them, like, why not save Woodland Park or Malibu or wherever you want, they'll say it's not their job.
Yeah.
And because they are the only ones that can afford air tankers, you have the one entity that can build these things saying it's not their job. They'll come try to defend your home a little bit, but only with the things that they budget for normally.
Right, right. Well, very interesting, Ed. I've been at your website here, firehogs.com, and it looks pretty neat. So certainly we'll encourage others to go take a look, and it sounds like you got a good idea there.
Yeah, and the sad fact of the situation is that with enough pain, something might actually happen. But like I said, we've had pain before.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Doug, thank you for hooking us up.
You're welcome. I'm glad my battery lasted.
Yeah, me too. Thanks. Thanks for calling, both of you men.
Good night.
Good night.
Nice.
All right. Well, that was nice. It seems, you know, every issue, whether it's what we could have known or done about terrorism or the incompetence of the government school system in America or the bureaucracy involved in fighting fires, when it's not my job, if the forest fire gets into a suburb, then it's not our job or whatever. The government doesn't work. It doesn't work. One of the main reasons, God gave the government two responsibilities, and it has taken on for itself 1,000 responsibilities. Let's go back to just criminal justice and infrastructure. That's it. This is Bob Benyart reminding you to do right and risk the consequences.